the past and future of socialism in America. To some, the very word socialist is a pejorative, interchangeable with communist, and demonized by cold warriors as the soul of the Soviet Union and Cuba. To others, socialism, or democratic socialism, is a way forward to restore equality in America, to meet the health care needs of its citizens, and to empower working people. Some polls show that more Americans, particularly younger ones, are open to socialism. But do they really know what it is? I'm Keith Shortall, and today on the program we'll explore the history of socialism in the world and in America, and define what democratic socialism looks like as compared to past iterations. We'll explore how socialized the U.S. has already become, and why some believe we've gone too far, while others say we've got a long way to go. Socialism in America, today on Maine Calling. First, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. The S word is being cast about with increasing regularity, but those on either side of the ideological spectrum have very different views of what socialism really means. Today we'll explore what socialism has looked like in this country and how it is being redefined on the political front. Joining me in the studio, Alyssa Mirage Graham. She's a visiting assistant professor of government and legal studies at Bowdoin College. Scott Erb, he's a professor of political science at the University of Maine, Farmington. And Michael Hillard, he's professor of economics at the University of Southern Maine. And as always, we want to hear from you. How do you view socialism in the U.S.? Do you think the U.S. is already embracing socialist principles? Are there limits beyond which you believe Americans will not go in extending socialized benefits? And if so, why? Our phone number is 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome to all of you.
Good to be here.
Thank you.
So
we're talking about a socialism today in large part because it's become this kind of political keyword, Alyssa, in the past few years. But let's test the premise. Has it become so? And if so, why?
Yeah, so I think there are a couple of reasons. So in the shorter term, the 2016 presidential election, and particularly the Democratic primary, saw Bernie Sanders, who is again a candidate, and who identifies as a democratic socialist, become a major contender in the campaign. And I think the reason that this happened when it did in 2016 is a little bit further back, and it's related to the 2008 financial crisis and Great Recession and the medium-term consequences of that financial disaster, which are still being felt by many Americans today. And so I think that that has really sort of brought into question why it is that the state responded to the crisis in the way that it did, and whether that the response to the financial crisis met market needs to the detriment of society's needs.
Yeah. Michael Hillard, was the Bernie Sanders phenomenon a surprise to you, or was this sort of pent-up dissatisfaction an opening to socialism that had already been there?
Sure, it was and it wasn't. And let me say first, we'll probably talk a lot during the show about what a socialism means. I think the socialism of Bernie Sanders is what Europeans call social democracy. And really, it's a sort of degree of liberalism that we've only seen, like, say, in the 1930s and 1960s. It's not calling for a communist revolution and the state to run the economy. So you got to keep that in mind. I'm not surprised at all because what's happened over the last 35 years is a distinct trend in two things, economic inequality and the rising power of especially the financial elite. And I think what Alyssa was just saying a second ago is that coming out of the 2008 election, where a centrist Democrat Barack Obama did not hold to account the financial leaders that caused the financial crisis. That made a country really, really mad, and it stoked anger about inequality. So I think that the rise of socialism is a political reaction to those two phenomena. I would add one other point, which is that really what I see the young generation recognizing, and that's been the economics of anybody coming of age in the last 10 or 15 years, is that you're coming out of school with $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 of debt. You're not going to be able to buy a home. You know, healthcare access has been uneven. I think what people want to see is a greater role of the government to provide a level of economic security that most people don't have now.
Yeah. And Scott, if you're coming out of school and you're worried about debt, you also didn't live through the Cold War.
Right.
And so you don't really understand when President Trump is in his State of the Union speech or whatever that speech was, when he was warning about the rise of socialism. This wouldn't really alarm you, but it does alarm many other Americans who were of a certain age.
Right. It's sort of almost, I wouldn't say an anachronistic use, but it's almost out of date, because communism of that sort really died, except for a couple of small, you know, like North Korea. And so President Trump is trying to bring back that emotion, that fear that there will be some huge state that will come over and take away your freedom. But if you look at Europe, all of the social democratic parties now, the parties that were the offspring of Marx and original socialism, they've all embraced market economies. They've all have embraced capitalism as the way to have the market operate. And then you use the state to try to correct the injustices or unfair results that market capitalism might bring, which is very different from the kind of bureaucratic socialism that communism had. And I think right now in the U.S., one group is trying to say, oh, socialism, that's just like those guys back in the old Soviet Union. Look what happened there. It doesn't work. Where another group is coming up and saying, no, but look at the injustices that capitalism has brought about. We need something to fix that. And it'll be interesting to see how the American public really works through this. What do they think socialism means? Do they get scared of it, or do they sort of embrace it? And that could be generational too.
So I'll stay with you, and we'll move on to the what's more relevant, this emergent social democracy or democratic socialism. But first, I want to go back a little bit about this connection between socialism and communism, which was real at the time. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to refer back to my favorite political philosopher, Ann Landers, who helped define it this way. Socialism, you have two cows, you give one to your neighbor. Communism, you have two cows, you give both cows to the government, and they might give you some of the milk. Capitalism is you have two cows, you sell one and buy a bull. Does she have it sort of right there?
Yeah, I think part of the problem is this general problem when you deal with ideologies. Ideologies are always vast oversimplifications of reality that people put together to try to make sense of the world around them. And if you take any ideology to an extreme, it doesn't work because it is an oversimplification. And I think what happened is that back in the 1800s, after the Enlightenment and with this new emergence of this kind of rationalist thinking, Marxism was an attempt to scientifically figure out how society should work, and communism was trying to force that into reality there. And that was the government taking over everything. And I think the reality is that politically these things become much more complicated and much harder to make sense of, because people make compromises with the real world and the isms end up changing. And so when you talk about isms, capitalism, socialism, and all of that, it really sort of becomes a bit misleading. But it's easy for politicians to use that. Whether Ann Landers is right, there's something to that. I mean,
I like to, also there's for surrealism, you have two giraffes, the government makes you take harmonica lessons.
I like that one.
I don't know, it's kind of weird. Alyssa Mirage Graham, is part of the confusion here, though, that even socialist Democrats aren't, from what I've seen in recent interviews, don't seem to be distancing themselves from the word socialism and acknowledging this sort of connection to the past and to the Cold War.
Yeah, so, well, I think that there's probably a couple of reasons for that. So as of 2019, millennials are the largest voting bloc in this country. And I was born in 83, so I'm an old millennial. I don't remember the Cold War at all. And so it doesn't have this sort of evocative emotional significance for myself and probably anyone younger than me, as it might for older Americans. And so I think that savvy politicians who are embracing some of these ideas don't see the need to qualify it because of how the audience has changed. And I also think that for some politicians, very progressive Democrats, actually capitalism has taken socialism's place as a sort of ism that turns out to be a liability, a political liability.
You've seen polling evidence of this among younger people. They're more comfortable, much more comfortable with this idea of socialism for the reasons that you've mentioned.
Yes.
Michael Hillard, is this being intentionally, do you think, confused? In other words, are conservatives well aware that social democracy is not the same thing that we were afraid of during the Cuban Missile Crisis, but are simply making sure they equate that because there's still this sort of visceral response?
Yeah, I'm not sure I know what's in their head and their hearts on this, but there's a long tradition in the United States of red baiting, and it has a couple of different forms. But during the Cold War era, for sure, and really in all previous history going back to the early 19th century, there was this attempt to say that anything to do with socialism or communism is un-American, and so you're ruled out of being an acceptable part of the political society if you advocate it. It took on a particular form in the 1940s that has relevance to today when very popular right-wing writer, economist named Friedrich Hayek said that the emergence of the New Deal, things like Social Security and union rights, represented a slippery slope to totalitarian communism. That's what's going on now. That's the sort of like, a Bernie Sanders or another Democratic candidate is saying, we would like to expand the public provision of some basic needs in society. And on the other hand, you have people saying, Venezuela, North Korea, the Soviet Union. So the thing is that I think that, for better or for worse, we don't have socialists in the country except for maybe a few small stripes that are advocating government ownership of the means of production, which would be one of the Ann Landers things that you read there. But instead, they're offering, something that looks like Europe and going back to Hayek and others, it's the slippery slope argument. As soon as you start talking about Medicare for all, next thing you know, they're going to come and take your car and not allow you to buy hamburgers and all the things you've been hearing as of late. So
I heard a point made, Scott, on a recent show by a caller who said, I don't know why we're looking to Europe as this great model. They basically imported it from us. They took from the New Deal and remade themselves after World War II, and this is what they did with it. So, is that a point that what?
I wouldn't say that they copied us. I mean, you have social welfare programs going back to the conservatives in Germany in the late 19th century.
Absolutely.
And the Scandinavians were moving towards social democracy back in the 1930s in a real interesting farmer and worker collaboration that didn't happen in other parts of Europe where the farmers were more conservative. I think it's interesting, too, that in Europe, conservatives almost all support what is called socialism here. I know some very conservative Germans, and they would never get rid of their healthcare system. They think our healthcare system is barbaric. And their argument is that, it's good for the society and of conservative values to make sure that people are treated fairly and justly. So the comparison of Europe and the U.S. becomes very odd sometimes because there's very different takes on this. And the reason you can have social democrats in Europe and not be so scary is I think they've sort of evolved into having a system that accepts social welfare alongside market capitalism as a way to get, if not the best of both worlds, at least a way to try to have the benefits of a market that will increase the allocation of goods and services with the state trying to make sure those benefits are more fairly distributed than the market would on its own.
So I'll let anyone jump in here. So is what's happening here in the U.S. then, so is this debate along a line of a imaginal line beyond which we won't go? So we'll pay for, we'll do welfare, we'll do Social Security, we'll do public schools, but we draw the line at childcare because if we go that way, we're a socialist and socialism is bad. I mean, is the debate being defined by how far we'll go?
You know, when I teach this in my basic introductory macroeconomics class, I say, look, there is all of this sparks and fire about labels and terms, but every modern economy in the world, other than save a few, is what Paul Samuelson, the mainstream economist, wrote 70 years ago. We're mixed economies. We're a mixture of market and government provision. That's all we have. And if it's 33% here and 47% in a typical European country, it's a difference of degree, not of substance. I really think that the thing that's going on in the United States now is sort of, first of all, those who call themselves socialists claiming that we don't do enough on the score of taking care of basic needs through government provision. But the other thing that's really underlying all this is a different discussion about capitalism in the United States. To me, that's what's most fascinating, because what's happened is that capitalism during the Cold War was equated with freedom and was not questioned and was thought to be just this kind of unilateral expression of human individuality, whereas now people see it as a system of institutions and policies that produce different outcomes. I would say the most interesting thing that any of the progressive Democratic candidates is doing right now is not talking about more social provision, which they all are, but it's Elizabeth Sanders saying, Elizabeth Warren rather, was quite a confusion there. Elizabeth Warren has proposed restricting the power of Wall Street to demand that corporations prioritize profits over stakeholders like communities, consumers, and workers. That's, I think, the heart of what's going on right now. And it doesn't get enough attention in this discussion.
But
can I just jump in here? So I think that to your question about whether this is being framed in terms of how far we go, I would actually say that it's sort of reversed. It's about, I think what's framing the debate is the major problems that we're facing as a society, which includes sort of unprecedented levels of inequality in the post-war era, the major existential threat of climate change, and can the market economy address those problems, and what are the limits of the market's capacity to address those problems? So I think that the debate is really being framed in terms of what the problems are. These are collective problems. And how can we best address them? Where does our best chance lie in terms of climate change? And so one of the proposals is that what we sort of might put under the large umbrella of socialism, more specifically, I think one of the louder sort of voices is in the democratic socialist emerging tradition, which is different from social democracy because it advocates for democratic ownership of the economy, right? So expanding democracy into the economic sphere as well. Right?
This whole, you mentioned Elizabeth Warren, as we're heading into 2020, Democrats, even progressive Democrats, are sort of, they're quick to declare, oh, no, I'm a capitalist. They're very nervous around abandoning the capitalist and fully embracing the term socialist, even, around this confusion.
I think one thing that comes out of all that too is that it really, really is focused on what you think about people who are in poverty or poor or not as well off, because that's always what is looked at as, oh, if you give them money, it's a handout. While the governmental system gives a lot of money to big oil, to big corporations, the tax cuts that were passed earlier mean that a lot of big corporations are paying no taxes. So one could say it's kind of like a reverse socialism. The wealthiest are getting the benefits, and they're pointing at the poor and saying, oh, but if you give them a fair share, then somehow that's bad. And so that, I think, is also driving a lot of the progressive Democrats, especially people like Elizabeth Warren, because they see that the structure that the government has isn't really capitalist as much as it is benefiting those who have money, who can get lobbyists and who can influence Congress, and often circumventing what normal market forces might force them to do.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your questions and comments, the number is 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do New England Cancer Specialists, proud to be a member of the Dana-Farber Cancer Care Collaborative, and committed to helping patients achieve their best outcome. And Salt Pump Climbing Company, helping to mentor the next generation of vertical athletes. Youth program information at saltpumpclimbing.com.
The Prime Minister of Israel is in the fight of his political life. Can Benjamin Netanyahu hang on for a fifth term? And how might America's decision to designate Iran's Revolutionary Guard as a foreign terrorist organization help him?
We're doing it because the Iranian regime's use of terrorism as a tool of statecraft makes it fundamentally different from any other government.
That's next time on 1A.
1A can now be heard Monday through Friday evenings at 9 here on Maine Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the role prosecutors have played in contributing to mass incarceration and the new movement of reform-minded prosecutors. We talk with Emily Bazelon, author of the new book Charged, The New Movement to Transform American Prosecution and End Mass Incarceration. She's a staff writer for the New York Times Magazine and teaches at Yale Law School. Join us.
And Fresh Air is this evening at 7 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, Understanding Socialism. Joining me, Scott Erb, a political science professor at the University of Maine, Farmington, Michael Hillard, economics professor at the University of Southern Maine, and Alyssa Mirage Graham, visiting assistant professor of government and legal studies at Bowdoin College. We invite you to join the conversation. The number is 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. From Constantino, socialism is bad unless you like having a military, police, and fire departments, schools, libraries, and parks. And the point obviously there is that in many ways the United States is already a socialized country.
Yeah, that's the point that was about being a mixed economy. And when you look at what I was saying earlier about how, say, German conservatives would never give up the healthcare system, it's just a matter of do you think, if you think police protection, education are a right that every citizen should have, would you add healthcare to that? And that isn't a radical ideology. That is a question of the scope. You've already embraced the mixed economy. It's just how far do you go? And I think the fear of socialism, the red baiting, that is designed to get people to not think about, well, maybe it makes sense that if you're a wealthy country, you don't want, you know, people to go bankrupt because of medical bills. We're the only country where that happens, at least in the advanced industrialized world. I don't want my 81-year-old mother broke her pelvis earlier this year, and not everything that she needs is covered by Medicare. That wouldn't happen in most other developed countries. So I think the use of the word socialism is sort of a way to veer attention away from thinking about the actual practicalities of these issues. And a lot of Americans, when they look at the practicalities of it, they say, yeah, maybe we should all have a good healthcare system and not be bankrupt by medical bills.
Didn't this happen somewhat with the Affordable Care Act? That is, some people were against it, and then once they got it, they didn't want it taken away. And this, this might be what happened in Germany as well.
Right. Yeah. And I think it stops being socialism once it becomes just part of normal life. Go back to something you brought up earlier about some of the presidential candidates who seem to be leaning that direction in the Democratic Party but not necessarily declaring themselves that. I think the focus is maybe a little bit too much on who's going to declare themselves amongst the presidential candidates, but what's happening within the base of the Democratic Party, especially a generational element. And the fact that, you know, various polls show something like half of millennials embracing socialism and far less than half embracing capitalism. I think it's, you know, that there is a commitment to really move that line of how much is provided through the state and hopefully reforming capitalism as well, that really matters.
To come back to the European example, I think that this is an important part of the generational shift. I think since I started teaching college students in 2011 as a graduate student myself, I've noticed that students have become more and more interested in the Nordic model, what's going on in the Nordic countries. And they look at places like Denmark, where university is not only free, but you actually get something like an 800 euro stipend, living stipend for your university years. And they look at this. Some of them go to these places on study abroad, and they come back, and they think, why can't we in the United States also have these nice things?
Let's go to the phones. We'll go to, we'll bring in Kathy, who's calling from Waldo. Hi, Kathy. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead. You're on the air.
Well, it's been a very good discussion so far, and I think you're all on the right track, just, you know, including capitalism in your discussion. That is the part that is not well understood in terms of what capitalism is. One of the first things that must happen in order for you to be a capitalist is that capitalists must accumulate wealth. In this country, being wealthy, accumulating wealth, and so on, is a virtue. I mean, look at people like Sheldon Adelson, Jeff Bezos, Bill Gates. They can have as much wealth as they want. And when it comes to doing something about that, of course, you named Elizabeth Warren. But, you know, this is not taught in school. We have to live in this country and see the inequality that happens in order for us to begin to understand what the sacred cow of capitalism is all about. And so naturally, anybody who talks about socialism, especially Bernie Sanders, people pick up their ears because they are already very sensitive to the inequality and the sacred cow that capitalism is.
Yeah, Kathy, thank you. I think you made a point that we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, you know, I think one of the things that if you're to look more in the kind of academic world, do people see themselves on the left? And I work in the field of labor history, where the focus for the last 20 years has been trying to make sense out of the political power of amassed capital and wealth in this country, and how it's shaped the course of our country over the last, you know, 100 plus years. We're looking at right now where 10, 15 years ago, there was a consensus in the Republican and Democratic Party that climate change was real and needed to be addressed, and that changed. And you can draw a straight line to the Koch brothers' funding of the Competitive Enterprise Institute and American for Prosperity and going out there and successfully changing half the country's mind on that. So we see a lot of problems that we face in the country that are motivating people to think either about socialism or more progressive version of democracy. And they're driving it by a recognition that one of the problems with inequality is not just the suffering of people on the bottom, but the undue influence over democracy of those at the top.
Yeah, Scott.
Yeah, I think that there is really been a shift. If you look at where wealth is distributed in the U.S., we were getting closer and more equal until around 1980. And since then, we've gone back to like the 1890s in the distribution of wealth. And way back in the 1930s, when Mussolini took over in Italy, an Italian communist, Antonio Gramsci, was wondering, why are the workers supporting Mussolini? The fascists don't care about the workers. Why aren't they supporting the communists? And he realized that what the fascists had done is create what he called a hegemonic discourse, or a kind of worldview that you could buy in that would be emotionally fulfilling, which defines the enemies, which defines what society is all about. And in some ways, I think in the U.S., if you look at Fox News and you look at some of the right-wing media and how they're portraying things, they're creating this kind of worldview, this way of understanding reality that doesn't look at some of the excesses of capitalism, that defines socialism this way. And to the extent that people buy into that, they will emotionally connect with this opposition to socialism in a way that doesn't really intellectually or rationally look at the problem, but it's just that they're buying into this kind of discourse. So I think the media and I think the way that the culture develops is part of this too, and that explains to some extent why Trumpism became popular and won in the 2016 election. There's a worldview or a way of looking and understanding or defining reality that pushes you, I think, in a certain direction, maybe away from a rational sort of objective perspective.
All right, let's go to Roland in Cornville. Hi, Roland.
Hi, how are you today?
Good, thanks. Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to say that I think this program today is just absolutely a wonderful program, and the guests you have on are really doing a great job. The point that I really wanted to make was that, you know, this country developed democracy through a revolution. But what I'm seeing today is that democracy is being redefined, but not through a revolution, but through the evolutionary process. If we look at how fast technology has advanced, it seems to me that society as a whole has not caught up to that evolutionary process. But this is a point in time right now where it is beginning to take place. You know, we listen to a lot of people talk about the negatives of socialism, but we live in a country right now where we have developed Social Security, which is a form of socialism, and yet it has worked very well. And the only thing that has caused its near demise is when you have people or corporations who have the ability to put their hands into that account and use the money for other things. So from that perspective, people say, well, see, you can see that socialism isn't working, but yet it has. It's a matter of defining it and redefining it so that it fits the structure of the society.
Yeah.
Government.
Yeah. Sorry, Roland. Alyssa.
Can I jump in? I think that the point that you raise about democracy, Roland, is really interesting because I think that this is a big thread here. So democratic socialists want to democratize the economy. And technological change has aided that in a number of ways. So one thing is that technology has allowed our society to become extraordinarily productive. So productivity has increased since the 1970s, although it is not reflected in the way that wages and wealth are distributed in this country. The other thing is that the political consensus in the 1990s and through the 2000s really favored a technocratic approach to government. So basically the idea here was that we have to leave the work of government up to the experts. And we're supposed to believe that the experts are acting in our best interest.
Because everything's so very complicated.
Yes, because everything's very complicated. You need to have, you know, extensive knowledge of financial markets to be able to, you know, manage the Fed, for example. So I think that we have seen in the post-financial crisis era some rejection of that on both the left and the right. Sometimes it's called populism. For the left, we can say that there's a sort of growing belief that people are capable of participating in the government of their society and that it can be facilitated by technology. So more participatory understanding of democracy is important for this.
Roland, did you want to continue briefly, if you could?
Well, yes, I agree exactly with what she's saying. I think that, as I said before, I think that we're at a critical point in this country where we're understanding that there are a lot of values within the form of what used to be called socialism, and we're taking those values that are good, and we're going to begin to use them in our society. Whether that ends up with a democratic socialist form of government or some other form, it's an evolutionary process that is moving forward. And it will continue moving forward. You know, there was a point in this country where corporations came in, businesses came in, and they developed, they used the resources and they developed their businesses in various communities, and they used the community as a help to develop their business, which in turn helped develop the society in which they were a part of. But sometime in the late 70s or perhaps the early 80s, we changed something. There was a time where a company had a particular office, and that was called personnel office. Well, sometime in that time frame, it changed from a personnel office to human resources, and it became a cold and calculated term because we then began to use people simply as a resource and not as a community or part of a bigger thing.
Roland, I'm going to have to cut you off there. I'm up against a break. I appreciate your thoughts. And again, if you want to join the conversation, the number 1-800-399-3566. We're going to take another quick break. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Maine Farmland Trust, celebrating 20 years of growing the future for farming. Share your stories and get involved at mainefarmlandtrust20th.org. Bernstein Scher, a law firm that helps its clients navigate the law and the demands of their industries. BernsteinScher.com. And Evergreen Home Performance, dedicated to helping homeowners qualify for efficiency main energy audit and insulation rebates. More at evergreenyourhome.com.
Coming up on the next Commonwealth Club program, journalist Emily Chang takes the pulse of Silicon Valley's gender equity programs. It's now a year after the exposure of widespread discrimination and sexual harassment across the technology heartland. She reveals how the industry that was supposed to be a new frontier of colorblind and gender equity policies became a hotbed of inequality and sexism. Go behind the scenes of Silicon Valley on the next Commonwealth Club radio program.
That's coming up today at 2 here on Maine Public Radio.
Being chief financial officer at a cannabis company is no regular desk job. There are bags of cash to move and big men carrying guns.
They have an ankle holster and, like, you know, another one in the small of their back, and they're wearing tactical gear. It's pretty crazy.
I'm Elsa Chang. What it's like to run a marijuana enterprise when most banks will not lend or open an account. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered is later today at 4 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, we're talking about socialism and what it means. Joining me, Michael Hillard is with USM, Alyssa Mirage Graham with Bowdoin, and Scott Erb with UMaine Farmington. Join the conversation. Give us a call. The number, 1-800-399-3566. We were talking with Roland before the break, who was making a case that something happened in the 1980s that may have laid the groundwork for some of what we're talking about today.
Absolutely. Well, I'm just going to make a quick pitch for a book. I just finished a book on the rise and fall of the Maine paper industry called The Fall of the Paper Plantation. It will be out on Cornell University Press next year. One of the things I focused on most is the change in ownership regimes in the Maine paper industry. And I think what Roland was referring to is that if you look at any paper mill community in the state, prior to 1980, those institutions were benefactors of the community and their workers. There was a strong identification of the workers with their companies because they were paid the highest. They were taken care of in terms of, you know, their kids would get jobs there. There was just this great sense of reciprocity, and it was allowed because corporations had an independence from stockholders before 1980 that disappeared with what economists call the financialization of the economy. So when you look at the rise of inequality and this sense of having lost something that happens, that used to happen, sort of mutual agreements and trust between employers and employees, it really reflects a distinct change in the character of capitalism. And I'll go back to Elizabeth Warren's insight of this is that she's actually proposed policies that would restore a kind of stakeholder model, which not surprisingly is sort of at the center of European economies. So it's not just that they have more benefits there, but capitalism functions differently. In Germany, workers have an outsized say because they elect half of the board of directors of their company, and they have these democratic units called works councils that have a lot of influence. And employees, workers in our economy right now really feel unrespected, left out, and not part of any kind of social contract. So I think there's a desire not just to restore more benefits from government, but a different kind of capitalism that's a lot more respectful and supportive of their workers.
Well, they have actual control. It's about power as much as it is benefits. Let's bring in Kevin, who's calling from South Portland. Hi, Kevin. Welcome to the program.
Hi, it's Evan, but that's okay. You know, earlier in your conversation, you were talking about use this term isms, the suffix isms, and there's this 1948 propaganda video, a short cartoon, a very Warner Brothers looking style, and it's put out by a Harding College. It's on YouTube. I encourage everyone to see it if you haven't seen it, but it's very much a part of the McCarthy era anti-communist effort. And the isms is obviously communism and socialism that they're talking about. But in this little account, they have they depict a fictional accounting of the rise of one of the most beloved industry sectors, and that's the automobile industry. So 1948, America's driving, loving their cars. And this fictional account is this person, some guy named Doan, who had time to tinker in his garage and invent the automobile. Again, it's fictional, but it's supposed to portray the benefits of capitalism as opposed to these other isms. But one of the things about it is this gentleman, this Doan, had time. He had time and resources to develop this invention. And if we're in an era where we encourage entrepreneurialism invention, universal basic income would be one of the perhaps most socialistic expressions of our ability to have human capital contribute to emerging markets.
Yeah, exactly. Alyssa, you said exactly. Can you?
Yeah. Yeah. So when you said that part about time, that was what I was reacting to. So one thing that a lot of people misunderstand about Adam Smith, who is considered to be the intellectual father of capitalism, is that there is a very similar example in his most famous book called The Wealth of Nations, where that I call the labor-saving boy. And basically, it's this young boy who is working in a factory with fire engines, and he would rather play with his friends. And so he comes up with this innovation that enables his job to be done by a pulley system instead of him, so he can play with his friends. And what's interesting is what doesn't happen. So in this scenario, what doesn't happen is that this boy doesn't lose his job as a result of this, right? He is motivated to save his time so he can engage in his in pursuits of his own interests. And in doing so, he comes up with this remarkable innovation. And he doesn't go on to sort of, you know, lose out because of it, right? And so I think that the lesson here is that for Adam Smith, an important part of the market economy was actually the absence of coercion, right? So people weren't coerced into wage labor in this particular scene of The Wealth of Nations. Yeah.
Yeah. Interestingly, Karl Marx liked Adam Smith. He said communism would make the economy run the way Adam Smith said it should. So there's an interesting link there. I think going back to what's happened, though, since the 80s, is one thing is the globalization of capital. It used to be that most investments were within your own country. Starting in the 80s, capital could flow all over the world. That's where you get outsourcing. That's why cars now that are, quote, Japanese, unquote, were probably made in the U.S. or Mexico or Canada. And this was caused in part by the technological revolution and the information revolution made it easier to do that. But when we get back to that issue of democratization, what we're seeing now with the information revolution, all this new technology, is equivalent to when the printing press hit Europe way back in the 1400s, 1500s. It's changing everything about politics. It's changing society. It's changing the way we communicate. And it will inevitably force a change in politics. It gives tools back. One of the reasons we centralized government is that you pretty much had to do that to control large organizations and large populations. Now, with all of this new technology, you could potentially decentralize and have localities and individuals have a bigger sense of power over what they do in their own lives. And I think what we're starting, this evolution, and in some way it may be revolutionary, we're starting a shift in the entire way society functions. And this new debate about socialism is bringing into that conversation just what kind of change do we need. And there's a sense that the way things have been working have been benefiting an elite, and now we have the tools to potentially change that.
And because of the confluence of all those things at a time when there's this generation emerging that is mm-hmm. so open, this is a different thing than what happened even in the 60s maybe, or maybe
Definitely.
maybe it's similar in the timing.
Yeah, again, I mean, you know, in the 60s you had a really prosperous version of capitalism that was far more humane than it is now by most measures. I want to make a pitch for the idea that more of what people are calling here socialism, meaning greater public benefits, public provision, can actually support capitalism and make entrepreneurship better. There are some countries, I know Italy allows people who are unemployed to take a lump sum of what would be 12 months of unemployment benefits and use it to start a business. I believe it's Sweden that allows workers to take up to a 9-month leave from a job to see if they could start a business and then get the job back if it doesn't go well. So, I mean, here in Maine, I think everybody sees the future of the state as entrepreneurship at a smaller scale within the state. And I know that if you're thinking about starting a small business and if you could rely on the government to provide health insurance, just as a basic thing, that it would really make entrepreneurship more possible. And interestingly enough, measures of entrepreneurship and economic freedom are higher in Scandinavia than they are in the United States.
Yes.
Yeah, let's go to Brian in Gorham. Hi, Brian. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Excuse me. Well, it's been very interesting so far. a lot of intellectual commentary. You guys obviously have some depth that you can fall back on, and that's great. But what I'm more interested in is solving problems that the ISA has and take examples from all over the world. I don't care. And I don't care if it ends up being socialism or capitalism. The point is to solve the problem. Somebody walks into the room and says, hey, I got a socialist idea. Forget it. Or I got a capitalist idea. Forget it. You're going to lose half your audience. I'd rather we talk about solving problems. And the other thing I want to highlight is I read a book recently by a Swedish author. The title of it is Factfulness. Any of you familiar with it? No, I guess not.
Yeah.
I was really impressed because it basically describes documents, how much better off the world is now than it was 20 years ago, 50 years ago, 100 years ago, indirectly supports democratic capitalism. So, you know, we want to keep as much of what we've got going on as possible and then solve the problems. And I don't care if it's the solution falls under the category of what ism. The point is solving the problem.
All right, Brian, thank you so much. And of course, just to go back to the premise of the show, I think that if you joined us late, we put together the show because there is this quote unquote debate going on about socialism, but the term means very different things to very different people, which makes it not a very useful discussion at that point because you're not talking about the same thing. And because it is this loaded word that even generations have a different view of and a degree of comfort in. Yeah.
Right. So to respond to the caller, one of the things that's going on here is that there's fundamental disagreement about what the problems are, right? So there's a big schism in terms of whether we should consider climate change to be an impending emergency, whether the level of inequality that we have in the United States now is actually a problem. So I think that that's kind of one of the big sort of hang-ups of this discussion is that we don't even agree on what the problems are.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, I agree with the caller at a real fundamental level, pragmatic looking at problems to be solved with cooperation between political parties and political groups would go a long way. The U.S. has been really bad at that. We've become very polarized. And it's partially partially the amount of money that's in politics. It's the way in which the two sides are sort of defining themselves by, oh, it's socialist or it's this way. And getting back to some way where people could say, okay, let's sit together and try to deal with these problems and not worry about the label would really go a long way to help.
All right, let's try to fit in a few more calls if we can. We'll go to New Hampshire and Wilson. Hi, Wilson. Welcome to the program.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, thanks. Yeah, go ahead.
I just had a quick question for the panel. Has any of the panel members ever lived in a socialist state? I was born in East Germany and had a pretty interesting perspective, but I could take my question off air. I just want to know what the extent of their experience is. So, thanks.
So I was born in Canada, which is not a socialist state in the way that East Germany was. But we do have universal health care in Canada and much cheaper university, among other things.
Child care in Quebec.
Yep. I've been in a number of emergency rooms, and the only place that I've ever had to wait in an emergency room is in the United States, not in Canada. I've also lived in Iceland for a year and a half while I was doing my research. And this is a Nordic country that has that is on the Nordic model of social democracy. And it's a completely different lifestyle.
What was your sense of how much of the success, if you want to call it, if the Nordic countries believe it's a success, how much of it of that system working well depends on the acceptance of the culture for it? In other words, were there cultural similarities between these countries which would fit much more readily with this kind of system than would this frontier mentality of many different types of people that in the United States.
So this is a really persistent myth about the Nordic countries, right? So we often hear, well, they can have social democracy because they're pretty much all white, right? And so they don't have these social divisions. But this completely sort of ignores the history of social democracy in the Nordic countries, which are certainly not perfect, but do perform very well in a lot of political, economic, and social indicators. And if you look at the actual history of social democratic Nordic welfare states, it shows that it's the outcome of a very well-organized labor movement and long-term struggle for these benefits. And it also shows us that solidarity and consensus is built. It is not something that we can take for granted. And it is built through things like universal social programs, which, like Social Security in the United States, are extremely popular and tend to promote further social solidarity.
To the caller, I've visited East Germany when it was still East Germany. I spent a lot of time there right after the fall of the wall, since my focus is German studies. I also spent time in Russia after communism ended. And I think when people talk about socialism today, they certainly don't mean that kind of system. It didn't work. The government tried to control everything. It was bureaucratized. Bureaucracies don't change. They're not dynamic. And that kind of system was destined to stagnate and fall apart. So I think when people talk about socialism, very few people would look at that as a model of what we would want to go to.
One last quick thought. I do think that one of the things that we're seeing right now with what happened to Obamacare is that once there's an expansion of the public sector into providing public goods like healthcare or housing or things like that, once it's established, it becomes an apolitical thing.
Right.
And that's a big part of what's all these different countries, including very much Canada. And I think we're seeing some of that now. And so I think the outcome of this conflict right now in our political system could be resolved by just creating a new normal 5 or 10 years from now.
Right. And that's the last word. Thank you all for joining
us. Thank you.
Really interesting. Thank you.
Great to be here.
Alyssa Miraj Graham, visiting assistant professor of government and legal studies at Bowdoin College. Scott Erb, professor of political science at the University of Maine, Farmington. And Michael Hillard, professor of economics at the University of Southern Maine. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as helpful links and resources, by visiting mainecalling.org. Today's show will be rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the show, join host Jennifer Rooks for a conversation about entrepreneurship in Maine. And if you're in the Bangor area, we welcome you to attend the live show at the Gracie Theater at Husson University. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.